Okay, hello Suzanne, Suzanne Beeke.
Hello.
You are here at the Science of Aphasia conference and you just gave a workshop about better conversations with aphasia.
I did.
And you are working at the University College of London.
Yes.
And there you developed this therapy program.
Yes.
And can you tell us anything about it? Just a short
I can. Thing. So Better Conversations with Aphasia is a training program for people with aphasia and their conversation partners. And it aims to help them to understand what is working well in their conversations, despite the aphasia, and maybe what's more challenging about having conversations after having aphasia, and give people the opportunity to choose and practice some strategies to help their conversations at home.
Okay, yeah. And I was wondering, we have in the Netherlands the PACT therapy program.
Yes.
Is that like the same kind of therapy?
Yes, or? it's very similar. So they are both communication partner training programs. Mm-hmm. And I know that Sandra Hewlett, who developed PACT, was influenced by a program we have in the UK called SPARK,
right.
which also influenced
right.
us when we were designing right. Better Conversations
yes.
with Aphasia.
Yes.
So yes, as I understand it, it's quite similar.
Yes. All right. I was thinking, like many years ago, you were one of the first people who were actually turning to conversation analysis and live interactions with people with aphasia as something worth studying. Am I right about it?
Yes. I became interested because I met Ray Wilkinson, who's a speech and language therapist and an academic in the UK, who I think was one of the first people to discover conversation analysis and apply it to aphasia. Conversation analysis has been around since the 1960s, but originally people used it to understand how human beings typically talk to each other, and it's only recently that it's been used to help us to understand how communication disorders like aphasia, but also dementia and some communication disorders that children will experience, how those affect interaction. So
What does it mean for you to be here now as one of the main speakers? Does that indicate that doing research on live interactions, conversations, has become mainstream more?
I think it has, yes. And I detect a huge enthusiasm amongst speech and language therapists to do this kind of work because they see that it helps people with aphasia and their family members with their everyday lives, which is ultimately what we want to do. We want to help people to participate in activities and talk to family members, but talk to new people as well, and have rewarding social interactions despite their aphasia. So I think it has become more mainstream in some countries. So we're here in Italy, and I've just been speaking to some Italian speech and language therapists, and they don't have a culture of doing training for communication skills. They very much still work on people's ability to find the right words and to put sentences together. So I guess I'm inspired to try to move things on in other countries too, so that we're all doing those things to help with words and sentences, but also doing communication partner training, which is also just as important, I think.
Yes, yeah, because you actually show in your work that linguistic competence that's a different thing from having a conversation or communicating with each other.
Yes. And so in my, when I did my PhD research, I wanted to compare particular speakers with aphasia, their ability to produce words and sentences on the kinds of tests that speech and language therapists often use, and in describing pictures, which we often ask people to do. I wanted to compare that kind of ability with their ability to have a conversation. And I actually found that it wasn't necessarily the people with more language or more sentences who were the better people in conversation.
Right.
So there seemed to be a missing part of the puzzle somewhere. And so that's what prompted me to do more research in that area.
But you often think of aphasia, of going through a loss of so many things because of a loss of language. But you have studied so many conversations. Can you see sometimes that there is something gained in conversation because there are language is not available?
That's interesting. I think that I have seen individual husbands and wives develop strategies that I'm sure they didn't use before one of them had aphasia, so I suppose in that way something is gained, and they've, some people do that spontaneously, and that is very fascinating to me, that, you know, people have the spontaneous ability to fix their own interactional problems, but other people find that much harder. And I guess what I'm trying to do is learn from the conversations of people where I can see new strategies working and help the other people to adopt some of those same strategies. So I think, yes, I think people can, new things can happen after aphasia in terms of strategies. But I also think that what can happen after communication partner training, so people with aphasia and their family members have reported to us that they talk more. So I suppose that's a change. And maybe, perhaps they talk in different ways than they did even before the aphasia happened. And they talk more as a result of the training. So
yes, and maybe then it's more an object of attention that there should be talk or there should be interaction.
And we all find that hard, to find those times in the day to sit down and have a chat. And sometimes it's not about sitting down, it's about doing it on the move or whilst you're preparing dinner or any of those kind of situations. So for me, it's about giving people with aphasia and their family members the ability to still do that, to have those snatched conversations. But make them enjoyable, and make them flow and make them easier, rather than them always being about problems with finding words or saying the things correctly.
I think that in your work you've always tried to connect with the people with aphasia themselves and their partners, so maybe from a more theoretical outlook in the beginning to developing this better conversations with aphasia program. And now you combine, you try to work together with people with aphasia in your research, like using focus groups.
Yes, so when we developed the Better Conversations with Aphasia resource, we had a focus group of people with aphasia who we were able to get together through a charity in the UK called Connect, which supported people with aphasia and was run by people with aphasia and did activities that they wanted to do. And our focus group were very influential on the resource that we developed, and they had input to the website and what it looked like and which parts of the information we made aphasia friendly mm-hmm. and which parts they actually weren't mm-hmm. interested in, and mm-hmm. they said to us, that's fine, you can leave that for the speech okay. therapists mm-hmm. but you can make this bit aphasia friendly for us. And we also video recorded them talking about their experiences of having conversations
okay.
with aphasia.
Yes.
And the effect of the aphasia right. on their conversations. And the thing that I remember most is the woman who told us about how when you have aphasia, conversation is all information, information, information. That's what she said. And it's much harder so it's easy to talk about what do you want to eat, where have you been, mm. but it's much, much harder to talk about your views on politics or on situations and your opinions about things. And that was what she missed the right. most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did she find a way, or can you imagine a way of getting that back in conversations?
I think that by focusing our research on conversation for people with aphasia, we understand better that our therapies should promote language use for giving opinions and talking about thoughts and feelings mm-hmm. as much as it should for reporting about events, mm-mm. so things that have happened. Mm-hmm. And I think in the past that speech and language therapy has focused too much on people saying, describing an activity or saying what's happened mm-hmm. And not enough on the language that they need to mm-hmm. express their feelings and their thoughts. Mm-hmm. But if we look at conversation, there is a way that we can balance that up better, I think.
Right, right. Do you have a vision of your own research, which direction it should take?
That's a very interesting question. So I would like to, we are developing more resources to help people who have a particular kind of aphasia where that we call fluent aphasia, so where they have a lot of language and they can talk very fluently mm-hmm. but it's harder for them to be very concrete about mm-hmm. what they want to say mm-hmm. so they tend to talk about lots of things and this and that mm-hmm. and one, and it's hard for the listener to work out what those things refer to and also they are people who tend to have great difficulty in when they have a trouble in a conversation mm-hmm. they know that they can't find the right word or that they've said the word wrong mm-hmm. but they have great difficulty in then saying the word correctly or finding the right word. Mm-hmm. So I would like for us to develop some resources particularly for people with that kind of aphasia and their conversation partners mm-hmm. because I think the challenges for them are slightly different.
Right, yes.
So that's one thing that we're planning to do. But also the idea of better conversations is developing to be broader than just aphasia. Mm-hmm. So we're doing some work in with my colleague Stephen Block in people with motor neurone disease mm-hmm. and their conversation partners, and then with my colleague Wendy Best and one of her PhD students Lucy Hughes, they're looking at promoting better conversations for children with mm-hmm. developmental language mm-hmm. difficulties. So better conversations is taking off in different
yes.
directions,
yes. Yes.
which is lovely.
Yeah. So that is what you envision, that's your work you have done already, that you apply it also to other types of people with aphasia
yeah.
or other types of diseases they can have.
And also to dementia, that's one of the other things that we're starting to look at. So I have a PhD student, Anna Volkmer, who's looking at people who get a young onset form mm-hmm. of dementia called, in the UK, called primary progressive aphasia.
Right.
So
right.
who, where their difficulties impact a lot on their conversations at first, but are their cognitive skills, so their mm-hmm. ability to think and to plan and to problem solve, remain relatively good, mm-hmm. At least for the first few years of the disease. So we're looking at resources to help conversations for those people as well.
Yes, that sounds very useful. I think we can round up.
Okay.
Maybe you can have a message to the people with aphasia and their partners who are readers of our website.
So I think my message would be, if you feel like you're someone who would like some help with your conversations at home, that you could ask your speech and language therapist about communication partner training, and that's something that your speech therapist will know about, and you can discuss with them whether that might be the therapy for you to try.
That's good. And I may add that for researchers, it is a very good idea, I think, to include the ideas of people, of the evaluations of people with aphasia in your research, as you are an example for us.
Thank you
very much, Suzanne.
Thank you, Christine.
Okay.